This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekiness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Critics say we should be watching these movies.
But we're here to see if they're right.
Join us as we take a cinematic journey through independent and classic film.
So dim the lights.
And get ready for the show.
This is Art House Legends Podcast, where high art and geek culture collide. Welcome to the podcast that promises only 10 to 20 million people get killed, tops. This is the Movie Dude Eric, and along with me are...
This is Kent, and fluoridation is the most monstrously conceived and dangerous communist plot we have ever had to face.
Hey, this is Chris, and I've been to one world fair, a picnic, and a rodeo, and that's the stupidest thing I ever heard come over a set of earphones until I heard Art House Legends.
Thank you so much. In this episode, we're discussing Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, starring Peter Sellers, George C. Scott, Sterling Hayden, Slim Pickens, James Earl Jones, Keenan Wynn, and directed by Stanley Kubrick. Gentlemen, we are now on to yet another Stanley Kubrick film. This is number 3, if I'm not correct. We did Full Metal Jacket, we
Full
did
Metal,
2001,
yeah.
And now we're on to Dr. Strangelove. And I'm just going to say this right now, of all the Kubrick films, this is going to be my most favorite of his work. Now, that might be saying how I'm going to rate this or not. I'm not going to tell you, because as anyone who's listened to the 2001 or to the Full Metal Jacket episode will tell you, I don't like those movies at all, period. At all.
Is this his shortest movie? Because that feels like it could be the reason why it's the most enjoyable. Because it's like...
I
was surprised it was only 95 minutes. I was very surprised.
It's political and Stanley Kubrick. It should be like 8 hours long, I feel like, you know?
Yeah. But it's well-paced, too. It's very well-paced, too.
Well, I mean, a lot of his earlier work is actually shorter. The Killing was, I believe, about 90 minutes. Lolita, if I'm not correct, was about 90 minutes.
I forgot about The Killing.
And I want to say Paths of Glory clocked in under 2 hours. Mm-hmm. Now, that said, though, yes, he's also made much longer movies at a time when he could have easily cut 90% of his movie. But that said, though, I can't help but believe that Dr. Strangelove is an oddity in the oeuvre of Kubrick's work, because this is the most unusual of his work. This is... all of his other films have a seriousness about them and a self-importance about them that has always kind of annoyed me, to be honest. This one is by far... the one that doesn't take itself the most seriously, and yet at the same time, he's also talking about a very serious thing. So, I guess the first thing we need to ask is, how did you find the satire and black comedy of this movie? Despite what you feel about the movie itself, but what did you think about how this movie utilized black comedy and satire?
It feels, I don't know how to say this. It's not forced. It's a very natural black comedy. Nobody in this movie knows that they're in a comedy. They're in the worst case scenario. But it's just how things are around them is funny. Like, you can't fight in here. This is the war room. I mean, just, it's like, this is a serious place of business. We call it war. So no fighting. That's geniusly hysterical, but at the same time, it's like, well, he's right. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, peace is our profession. By that, I'm talking about the military bombers that are out to blow up anything that they want to. So, but what about you, Chris? Where do you fall on this?
I mean, I mostly agree. It does feel very natural, and it just kind of makes me wish Kubrick had done more of like this subtle satire that's Dr. Strangelove, you know? I mean, he's so serious later on and everything else, and I don't know. I wanted to, like, more... As I get older, I feel like I enjoy comedy more. Like, just the writing aspect of it and, like, pulling off something that's actually funny. And the fact that he had that ability and only did it once, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah. And I think it should be noted kind of how this movie came to be, because he was in the middle of doing Lolita. And he was kind of being paying attention to the Cold War. At this particular point, we had just gotten out of Korea. The Soviet Union got their hands on the nuclear bomb. And now it seemed like at any time we could find ourselves in a nuclear war. And Kubrick, being the very introspective individual that he is, as we have talked about on his other movies, did a lot of research on it. And he did a lot of research on the protocols and the machinery of war. Not just the actual machineries, but the mechanics of how these decisions are made. And as he was deciding to adapt a serious war movie about, you know, about nuclear annihilation called Red Alert, he decided that this was actually more funnier than it was scary. And so he readapted it and turned it into a satirical comedy. And I think part of it also kind of helped that he was also very good friends with Peter Sellers, who worked with him on Lolita. And between having Peter Sellers as your go-to guy and kind of this weird, crazy idea for a comedy, at this particular point, I think that the rest kind of fell in place from there, right? Because the rest of the movie does feel, especially considering if you look at the actors that are in this movie, and I don't know if you've actually heard of these actors before, with the exception of George C. Scott, because, you know, we've already talked about him with Patton and with Inherit the Wind.
James Earl Jones.
Well, that's true, but we've also yeah. seen James Earl Jones not but about a month ago
yes.
in, you know, straight hair, you know,
yeah.
being a snake. So I feel like that his seriousness has always had a sense of fun about him, and that he is capable of being in on the joke as much as anybody else. But like George C. Scott, let's be honest here, I honestly believe that he came out of his mother's womb with a scowl on his face.
Yeah.
Alright. And, you know, Sterling Hayden, which I don't believe we've actually talked about before.
I don't think so.
But, you know, he's mostly known for being hard asses in movies. You know, he had done a Kubrick movie called The Killing, which I believe is, like, Kubrick's second movie that he made. And Slim Pickens, who... You know, is mostly known for being a cowboy type, you know, in playing cowboys. So, yeah, he made sure to put actors in this movie that were serious, or at least seen as serious character actors. And with the exception of Peter Sellers, who was well known for being a comedian, and especially with the BBC, and had, I believe the Pink Panther, the original Pink Panther, had come out.
I don't think it was out yet.
Oh, perhaps.
So I was checking IMDb, but yeah, that's eventually he will be famous for it. So
yeah, but you know, but at the same time, though, Sellers was already well known as a comedian, and for his comedy, especially his impersonation skills, his ability to change his voice, but yeah, so all of this kind of culminated in came to be what we'll call Dr. Strangelove. And every time I see this movie, I'm going to go ahead and give a little bit of this away, but every time I watch Dr. Strangelove, I laugh my ass off. I have seen this movie maybe 15 times already, and every time I watch it, I laugh hard. And there's four scenes specifically that no matter if I watch it in context of the movie or if I see a clip, I immediately start snickering because they're just so damn funny. And we'll be talking about those four scenes later. But I guess the next question I should have is, did you find yourself laughing at this movie?
You know, I found myself extremely entertained. I don't think I actually laughed out loud, but I smiled a lot and went, yeah. It's like...
Fair enough.
It was giving me happy glows, or that Earth's radiation.
What about you, Chris? Did you find yourself laughing at the movie? Was there ever a point where you just kind of snorted?
I snickered a few times, I think, but I didn't really laugh out loud.
Well, I will... Definitely, I guess I should maybe say that I am the super fan of this movie. I'll just come out and say it right now. I absolutely love this movie 15 times. I think there's no way that I'm going to come after seeing it 15 times and say, no, it's not that good.
It's
no,
okay.
Yeah, 15
times.
It's
fine.
No. Let me put it this way. I have owned 5 different copies of this movie. Every time that they make a new copy... For like DVD or Blu-ray, I pick it up. And this is one of only 2 movies that I do that for. Not saying what the other one is. But, although if you know me well, you know exactly what it is. But anyway, that said though, let's go ahead and let's talk about this movie because there is so much to go over. Oh. Now, the movie itself... was made in 1963. That was 1 year before, 1 year after the Cuban Missile Crisis. And in fact, it was supposed to come out in theaters on November 22nd, 1963. Do you know what happened on November 22nd, 1963?
Let's see. 2 things. It's the day before Doctor Who premieres, and it's Kennedy's assassination.
Yeah.
Not a good day.
So needless to say, the last second they pulled it and
some re-edits.
They held it out. Not re-edited, but basically they just shelved it. It's a lot easier to do that in 1963 because the way that they rolled out movies, and they didn't have it out in like 1,000 theaters. It was mostly like in like New York and Los Angeles and Chicago, and then from there it expands. So they were able to push the premiere for a few months, and then it came out. And needless to say, it definitely caught the attention of Hollywood.
Well, I know from the special features I watched, there's a line that needed redubbed.
There's 2 lines, actually 1 line and 1 scene that had to be taken.
They had to cut. So, I mean, the original, when Major Kong says, you could have a great time in Vegas with this, it was Dallas.
No, you can see on the, ADR'd it. You could tell.
They ADR'd. You could read his lips and it's like, that isn't Vegas, so.
But, yeah, if you're reading his lips, you could tell what he was saying. But, and then, of course, late in the film, a pie fight was supposed to occur, and someone was supposed to say that our young president has been struck down. And that felt oddly...
not right.
Yeah. So that changed the ending. But I'll tell you right now, I think it would have been for the best, in my opinion, if we're talking about what we have as the end of the film. But I guess the first question I'm going to ask is, knowing what you know about the Cold War and about the possibility of nuclear annihilation during the Cold War, do you think that the film captured the right essence for that, or do you feel that it's kind of caught up in hysteria? Kind of like how with the Vietnam movies that came out during Vietnam weren't really that good, that it kind of took a few years after the war before the really good Vietnam movies started coming out?
I'd almost have to be alive in the 60s to answer that. Hey, I'm an end of Cold War baby, so...
I don't know enough about the Cold War.
I think I was 8 when the Berlin Wall came.
Yeah, well, I was a senior in high school. So, I mean, I survived the 80s.
I was pissed off about the Berlin Wall because it would cut into Ninja Turtles.
Priorities, man.
Yeah.
Ninja Turtles are important business.
Yeah, we always had that. I mean, I didn't have to do the drills or anything, but it was always there.
Mm-hmm.
We always had, hey, do you know your city is targeted by like 4 nukes? So like, yeah, okay. So,
what else?
So did you have to do duck and cover?
We never actually did those drills, yeah. So which is kind of a surprise. But we did. I think we saw those films and made fun of them because even by the 80s, they're like 20 years old, and it's like. Okay, yeah, like that's gonna do any good.
Well, it keeps you from doing something you're not supposed to be doing, like drinking, smoking, having pre-nuclear bomb sex,
yeah,
stuff like that. Yeah, I mean, you've seen that scene in Airplane where, you know, they say don't panic and everyone just panics, and then you know, like a woman, topless woman, just starts running around.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't need that happening just before the apocalypse.
No. Drink more fluorinated water. No.
But what about you, Chris? Do you think that the film captures the essence of the Cold War or what you know of the Cold War?
See, my problem is I don't know a whole lot about the Cold War, so I lean more towards the hysteria part, but I'm like, no, hysteria is good. It's fine. I'm happy it, you know, rests there.
Well, I mean, I guess we could also kind of tie it into something that we all have gone through, and I'm assuming that we've all gone through, which was the 9/11 scare.
Mm. Yeah.
Right? So, in a way, could you say that the film kind of captures that sense of insanity? Like, if someone had done to 9/11 what Dr. Strangelove had did to the Cold War... Mm. Could you kind of see the film in that light?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say so, yeah.
So, another aspect about the film that I find very fascinating about kind of how the film deals with this subject matter, especially considering that this is basically an apocalyptic movie, is that the film seems to focus almost primarily on violence and sex. In fact, did you realize that the first scene of the movie is actually a sex scene?
Mm-hmm.
But do we feel it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, did you notice that there's a nice long rod, firm rod?
Oh, come on! It's a mid-air refueling. I don't think we have to be sexual about.
Is that what we're calling it now? Mid-air refueling.
it's over for a mid-air refueling.
It's pumping life-affirming fuel.
The vital fluids into... That implies the bomber is female and is going to give birth to a nuke.
Well, it's pure essence. I'm just saying. But no, in fact, no, Kubrick is outright... Has made it very clear that this was in fact intended to be a sex scene, and violence scene. The fact that this was a bomber that was getting boned, and then of course it will go and bone something
else. Considering
that
it's the front and not the rear, wouldn't it be more not a boning but a oral fixation?
Not all people's genitalia. Or between their legs. I think you know that.
It's genitalia.
Mm-hmm. Just saying.
Wait. Okay.
You saw that episode of Stargate when someone hit the guy that creature's elbow and it goes down.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, was that Stargate or Star Trek?
One or the other. I could be wrong.
Oh, it was one of the Star Trek movies.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
Alright, fine. It had the word star somewhere in it.
Yeah.
But seriously, though, I mean, if you look at it, almost every scene in the movie either is dealing with sex or is dealing with violence. It's either purposely in, it's purposely getting us closer to some sort of violent penetration or sexual penetration. And in some instances, it's the exact same thing. You know, where the bombers have pornography right up on the, you know, on the this kill screens. You have, you know, you have General Turgidson, you know, basically talking sex to his mistress, or I guess his girlfriend, while dealing with, you know, war issues.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the whole thing is launched by Jack the Ripper.
Jack D. Ripper.
Jack D. Ripper, but, you know, that's obviously the name of somebody who killed prostitutes, so. Yeah.
Well, that's true, but we never see him, we never see him, you know, killing anyone outright with the, and we don't even see him kill himself.
He ordered a nuclear strike.
He did.
That's murder. Okay.
Well, one thing that I find very interesting here is the use of bombers and the fact that that there's something very impersonal about bombing someone. And I think that Kubrick also sees that, because look at how casually the pilots act about the idea of dropping nuclear bombs. You know, when they're, even when Slim Pickens is talking to his men about, you know, the seriousness of what's happening, he's not mentioning the amounts of death that's going to happen. He's talking about how there might be some promotions in this for everyone once they get back. You know, they're not, you know, considering that, that Plan R is basically stating that a nuclear bomb has been dropped on Washington, that America has been attacked, that the president and the Joint Chiefs have been killed, because that's what gives General Ripper the ability to launch the nukes. But that seems to kind of, is kind of seen as, okay, so I guess that happened. You know, they don't seem to be affected by the impact of what this means, with the exception of, okay, well, we're just going to go and bomb the Russians, or the Ruskies, as our pilot, as Kong puts it.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, they are going after military targets. They're not going after civilians. So that's probably part of the, okay, we're going in toe-to-toe against them. It's military on military.
Yes and no.
So, I mean, they're going to kill innocents, but they're not going to, it's not like, we're going to bomb the city of 40,000 people. No. So.
But think of it this way: the target that they eventually bomb is an ICBM factory, which means that it must have civilians. It's not just soldiers. Soldiers aren't the ones that are going to be making these ICBMs. Just like when we have military.
It's a factory. I thought it was a lunch site.
No, ICBM factory is what they say. Because their primary and their secondary targets aren't available. They can't get those. So they had to find just any target that they can get to. And they could, and I guess that's the one of the hilarious things about this movie is there's a million ways that this could have stopped, that Doomsday didn't have to happen. But all the wrong decisions were made at the wrong time. And it was pretty much inevitable that this was going to happen. And that's something that I especially found very interesting watching it this time. Look at the way that all of this occurs, from how Ripper sends the Plan R, to the way that Washington responds, to the way that the Joint Chiefs sent the commando force to take the base back, to the way that they... the way that the president gave all the locations of the bombers to the Russians so that they could fire the missile at the plane, which knocks out the radio. All of that was made by bad choices. All the bad choices were made. But at the same time, if you look at it from the characters' perspectives, They all think that they're doing the right thing. And that's the funny, that's the sad, funny aspect of this. This is why you kind of laugh at it to stop from being freaked out by it. And I especially love the fact that before all of this occurs, even before we get the Columbia Pictures logo, we get a little indicator saying how the United States military guarantees you that this could not happen due to the safeguards that they have. But in a way, part of me feels like Kubrick, even if the military didn't insist that this that they put this in there, and there is a possibility that the military did for this exact reason, I feel like Kubrick would have put it there anyway just to reemphasize the arrogance of the military, right? Like, we have all these safeguards. There's no way that this could happen. Yeah. Yet it could. I mean, again, like I said, if you look at all the safeguards that were there, it should not have happened in the movie, but it did.
It's a very loophole that one general was doing, but it seems like there would have been a little bit more oversight on him just to make sure he couldn't do that, even though, yeah, the point of the directive is, of the order is, hey, everybody above you in chain of command's dead. Oh, I better do this.
Okay, but here's the question that I have when it comes to the military command.
Yeah.
Now, the commander's name is General Jack D. Ripper. What person in the Pentagon would sign off on General Jack D. Ripper as the base commander with the ability to launch nukes? Even if the guy was a church-going Baptist who doesn't even like to use the word darn, I wouldn't give him a nickel close to the nuclear codes just because he has that name. He would have to change his name to...
Yeah, go ahead. You're going to discriminate based on the fact that he just happens to be named after somebody else? I mean, come on.
General Jack, yes. I'm absolutely going to do that. I mean, he might be the nicest person on the planet, but I would not give him the nuke codes. Just saying. But, I mean, seriously, though, I mean, let's put it this way. If you have some guy rising up the ranks with the name of Killer McKillkill, would you give him the nuke codes?
What's his resume look like?
Yeah.
I don't care if, like, again, he could be, you know, the happiest, sweetest guy on the planet who's, you know, spends his time cuddling puppies and taking care of baby chicks. I'm sorry. I'm not giving him nothing that would allow for the murder of millions of people.
Couldn't it have been, like, a nickname? I mean, I know he has a name on his desk, but, I mean, that could be... Don't they have, like...
Jack's a common enough name. Ripper's a common enough name. Come on.
Jack Delano Ripper?
Yeah.
But the fact that they seem to be perfectly happy with the D being in the in his name like that, you know,
it turns out there's already another Jack Ripper who is an officer in the Air Force, so.
Yeah.
He had to have the D in there just to make sure.
Okay, so let's go ahead and let's talk about General Jack D. Ripper and Sterling Hayden, because I am fascinated by this performance because of all the actors. Sterling Hayden is easily the creepiest character and the creepiest performance in the movie, and yet at the same time, he really doesn't do a whole lot. A lot of it is just him staring with a cigar in his mouth, talking more and more like a certain Starfleet captain.
Oh, I was thinking he talked more and more like people I know that listen to too many conspiracy shows about fluorinated water.
Or turning frogs gay?
That sort of thing.
He
has that exact same... People have the exact same tone. They talk just like him. And it's like... And this is decades before that became...
Well, have you noticed that when it comes to Ripper, with the exception of the first scene in the movie, as soon as his plan has gone into effect, he has the same cigar in his mouth? In fact, if you want to think about it, the entire movie takes place over the course of 2 hours.
Yeah, it's almost real time.
Yes. And so he had, I mean, from the moment that the plan is taking place and that it can't be stopped, he has a cigar in his mouth and is constantly there, constantly wagging up and down in his lips, and especially with the way that the camera seems to focus up on him, you know, where it's looking up at his face, and the way that the shadows kind of go across his eyelids, you know, or kind of his eye sockets. So it kind of has that skull look.
Yeah.
Did y'all kind of notice that?
Yeah.
And also the fact that, you know, he does have this big brown, you know, pole in his mouth. Paging Dr. Freud. Especially considering what we find out, how he came up with his fluoridation theory.
Yes. That's, yeah.
Yeah. Did you notice that too, Chris?
No.
Also, think about this. You know, when the soldiers are coming close to gunning him down, he pulls out that big ass machine gun. Mm. But if you'll also notice that when he pulls it out, where is he holding it, and where are his legs?
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Well, then again, that's really not a shoulder mounted weapon, but yeah.
Well, I think it was intended for that whole purpose. Because he is definitely firing it from the crotch. And he is definitely not losing his vigor, so to say. Just saying. Mm-hmm. Just saying.
Yeah.
But I guess we should also talk about the first of the Peter Sellers characters, which is Mandrake.
Yeah.
And what do you think of Mandrake as a character? Where does he lie in all this? What is his role in this?
He is so stereotypically British, it hurts. So, oh dear. Are we in a shooting war with the Russians? Like, who else would you be in a shooting war with? Come on.
Well, I mean, think of it this way. Like, the first time we see him, he's being told to go into... You know, that they're going to be locking down the base and, you know, starting the attack. And at first, you know, he thinks that this is a drill. You know, he finds out that this is Plan R. And the first time that I saw this, I loved how Mandrake deals with it. Oh, hell.
Yeah.
Like, not terror so much, but just like, ah, damn it. We have to go to war? And of course, you know, especially if you take that into account, like when Ripper is asking him to feed him the bullets, you know, feed the bullets into his big ass machine gun, you know, Mandrake
my
deals
leg.
With...
Yeah, I can't do it. My leg's injured. Yeah.
The string.
But did you also notice?
Yeah,
the string is like. String. Did you also notice what Ripper says, which is pretty hilarious? Exactly who he's talking to. Come on, Mandrake. The redcoats are coming.
Coming, yeah. Makes a lot of anti-British jokes talking to a guy who's my loyalty isn't to the Constitution of the United States, right? It's to the Queen.
He's there with the enlisted exchange program, which I don't even think that's even a thing. An officer exchange program. Is that even a thing? Like,
I'm trying to think if it was at one point, because it would have been.
I mean, this is NATO, definitely.
It is NATO, but why would he be that deep in United States territory? So,
well, we don't exactly know where Burleson Air Force Base is. Also, I gotta admit, I love the names of these bases. You have Burleson Air Force Base, Laputa, the military base at Laputa. There's something really just kind of goofy and funny about these titles, right? I mean, even the names. I mean, you know, Merck and Muffley. You know, we have. Like Mandrake and Jack D. Ripper, but we also have General
Guano.
No, we have Back Guano.
Which,
you know, we all know he's full of shit. Yeah. But you know, we have Buck Turgidson, which is anyone else thinking about like a really hard shit when you think of Buck Turgeson?
You know, now that you mention it, that is...
Kinda, yeah.
You know?
I gotta take a target shit.
You know, we have Doctor Strange Love. Well, we have, yeah. You know, Major Kong.
Lieutenant Zog. That just screams... That sounds like a name that should be in Star Wars. There, sort of who you played Darth Vader. But,
mm-hmm. But yeah, I love these names. It's part of the joke, right? It's kind of meant to be a little funny.
Well, it's funny at the same time. Got to keep these names as far away from anything that could possibly be real.
Mm-hmm. And should we mention that the Russian premier's name is Dmitry Kisov?
Kisov, yeah. Ambassador Sadisky, which almost sounds like sadistic or something.
Okay, well, there's actually one name in all of this that I am fascinated by when we get into it. But we'll talk about that in just a little bit. But honestly, we have to talk about who I think is honestly the best character in this movie, and that's General Buck Turgeson. George C. Scott himself.
He chews more scenery per minute than just so over the top. And
I love this performance. This is in that top 10 of greatest performances of all time, in my opinion. You know, we talked about Patton. We've talked about how great George C. Scott is when it comes to acting. And almost every time he's playing a serious character, he is a serious actor. I don't think I've ever seen him go as balls out as he goes here. And holy shit.
It's amazing.
From the moment he steps out of the bathroom,
Before he steps out of the bathroom, when it's just his voice, and it's just that that transferred conversation, he says he already called the base. Well, tell him to call again. The general would like you to call again.
But I mean, like you know, he's coming out, and you know, we know he's a general, and then he comes out in that really tacky shirt and his boxer shorts, and he just slaps his stomach like. You know, just like this overconfident, you know, like military type, and just plays up in the way that he plays with his secretary, the way he does, Miss Scott. You know, like there's so much going on in just that one scene, and I didn't realize that was all one take. That was all done in one take.
Yeah,
that's impressive. That's a really impressive shot, especially considering this is a mirrored room, first off. This is almost all dialogue, and it does have to zoom in a couple of places. It's really impressive, and the fact that the camera really doesn't move around a whole lot, right?
Yeah.
But, I mean, and just the way that it gets the character across, like, the first moment we see Turgeson, we know what kind of guy this is, right?
He's always right, because he says he is. Yeah.
Well, he's got a lot of bravado. You know, he's definitely a player. We see how he deals with Mrs. Scott. I love the fact that one of the... this wasn't in that scene, but in another scene when he's talking to Miss Scott, you know, he says, "Well, I absolutely respect you as a woman, or as an individual. I hope to make you the next Mrs. Buck Turgeson."
Yeah, I mean, the next. Yeah.
You know, it's the fact that she doesn't even have an identity. She wants to make her Mrs. Buck Turgeson, not Miss Scott Turgeson. You know, had no identity of her own, just a member, a part of his identity.
Yeah.
Right? I also love the fact that he constantly, whenever he's, you know, throwing a temper tantrum, he's constantly throwing in another stick of bubble gum in his mouth.
He's got so much gum in his fucking mouth, man.
Yeah. Well, when we first see him, he's getting a call in a hotel room, which mm-hmm. tells me just about everybody in this film, if they have to get a hold of them, you don't get them at home. You get them at some hotel room that they're known to always go to. Like the Russian premiere. Oh, you won't get him there. You got to call up this place because, yeah, you know what he's doing.
Well, he's also drunk.
Yeah.
Okay, so.
General Pickett right, said you better call this hotel.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about the war room. First, let's talk about the room itself. What do you think about this set? This is a Ken Adams set. We've talked about Ken Adams before. You know, one of the most amazing set designers of all time. He's one that was specifically known for doing the sets for the older James Bond movies, you know, especially the Connery and early Roger Moore types. What do you think about this set?
It feels very like a mix. The where they're sitting in relation to the whole room feels like a mix between a Bond villain and the Knights of the Round Table.
Well, I think that the Knights of the Round Table is definitely an influence.
Yeah.
What I especially love about the way that the table is that the table itself is this big round table, right? But there's absolutely nothing that you're going to be able to put like in the middle of that thing. And the fact that, especially when you have the wide shots, you hear the echoes of the people talking, and so you think to yourself, they're actually having to shout at each other in order to have themselves heard by the other person on the other side of the table, right?
You figure they could have acoustically done something to it so you could just talk normal and get heard by whoever's on the other side, but...
Well, we don't see anything like a speakerphone or anything, yeah. So, and again,
but,
you...
I swear when Turgidson's on the phone going, "Yes, honey, okay, we'll be home, it'll be done soon," it almost seems like the president can hear him.
Oh, no, it's not the president he's worried about hearing him, it's the other generals.
Yeah, well, the president would probably not be happy if he's having an affair with his secretary, but...
Well, no, I don't think the president cares. I mean, this is the 60s, you know, it's not exactly that era where you worried about office indiscretions. Yeah, and let's be honest here, as we find out, like, in the next scene, Miss Scott is actually... Well, she is a Playboy playmate.
Yeah.
So, gotta give her that. I love the fact that Miss Scott is seen, you know, sprawled out with the only thing covering her as foreign affairs.
Yeah.
So part of me wonders if, like, that issue with Playboy is, like, the women of the Pentagon.
They never allow that.
Well, in real life.
Or she did the pinup and then she got the job. Because General Turgidson liked it.
Yeah, well, Turgidson and I definitely get the sense that he has a subscription to Playboy.
Yeah.
You know, maybe that's what he was looking at when he was in the bathroom.
I could see it.
But also another... Go ahead.
Oh, I just said I could see that.
Yeah.
Also, another aspect of the room that I like is I love the halo light around, you know...
Oh, yeah.
On the top. Which kind of gives it that futuristic element to it, but it also you could also kind of see it as this artificial halo, like they think that they're on the side of the angels, but they're not, kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And especially with the big boards all around.
Whoa, did you mention the big board? Look at the big board! Go. Yeah, I love the big board.
I love Turgidson's fascination and terror of the big board, and that anybody will see the big board that isn't supposed to see it. Yeah. I mean, that gives away everything, doesn't it?
It does, but it doesn't. I mean, it's like it's probably nothing the Russians weren't already know. It's like, I mean, walking in, he'd be like, "Why does that look like there's an attack on my country?" Like, oh well. But it doesn't show, like, anything vital. Like, here's where the submarines are hiding. No, it's not showing that.
But, okay, so we have an exposition dump in the first scene of the war room. And actually, I love this because the way that they give the exposition dump is that the president is wondering, well, how on earth did this happen? But we find out He was the one who authorized it.
Yeah.
He's kind of forgotten all the things that he signed and all of what the politicians have done in order to secure, you know, in order to have a deterrent for Russian attacks on Washington and on the chain of command. And I especially love how, you know, all of these kind of maneuverings are things that they don't tell the other person, but perhaps they should say just in case.
Yeah.
Because the doomsday device is definitely a deterrent, and Planar is definitely a deterrent, but both deterrents only work if the other side knows that they have them.
Gee, where did you get that from? Is it from a German?
Don't blame the German for this. The German ain't responsible. I will say that we'll get to Strangelove in just a second. But one thing I absolutely love is I love the fact that when it is brought up that, well, why didn't you tell anybody about this? Wait. We were going to announce it on Monday.
Yeah.
You know how the premier loves his surprises.
Which is completely hilarious, and at the same time, we've all known politicians like that,
But at the same time, the movie actually sets this up with Ripper. Ripper brings up in an earlier scene how, you know, in World War One, it was said that that wars are too important to be left in the hands of generals, but now it's too important to be left in the hands of politicians. And then we get to see the president, who is a politician, and how the politicians have, in fact, in their hastiness to retaliate and to have a retaliatory action ready, basically set up the ability to give a disgruntled, crazy general the ability to literally start either a war or the apocalypse.
Same thing during the Cold War. So,
but again, I love how this all sets itself up like that, and how it creates these insights. And again, if you go back to how all this is kind of leads up to one another, all these decisions all line up to how we get the ending that we get. If one of these things had not happened, this would not have happened, right? And yet it was pretty much inevitable because all the different machinations that occurred for this to happen all did it with the best intentions, with what they thought was right. Hell, even Ripper thinks that what he's doing is right. He's, you know, he is scared about communist infiltration.
He's scared of the water.
And the way he sees it is, well, we need to stop them now, otherwise they're going to infiltrate and take over us, kind of body snatcher style, apparently, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and in a way, you could also say that the Russians, that the Soviets are also doing the right, you know, doing the best intention thing themselves with the doomsday device, which is, well, we're spending all this money on, you know, trying to keep up with you on the arms race, the space race, and the peace race.
I just like the way he says that. Arms, space, peace. I mean,
but I mean, if you think about it, it would be a great deterrent.
Yeah.
But again, you have to let people know that you have it, and definitely don't hook it up before you make the announcement.
Yeah, that would be the only problem. If it wasn't hooked up, okay, but.
But again, the premier loves his surprises. But yeah, that's the beauty of what this movie does is it just sets up these pieces one by one, line by line, and it does so in a way that allows us to laugh and it's an uncomfortable laughter that I'm getting when I watch this movie, because let's be honest here, we should not be having fun with this. This should be pretty fucking scary. right? I mean, and especially like if you look at it with in today's eyes, you can kind of see the same things happening, right? You can make that jump from then and now. It's not that difficult to make that jump, right?
I think if it happened today, the Russians would know about it way beforehand. They might even know about it before the president knows about it.
That's the thing, though.
So
could they? And on top of that, how would that change anything? We would still have mutually assured destruction.
Yeah.
Which again, if you look at the acronym there, MAD.
Yeah.
I mean, this is in all of this is kind of crazy in that sense. And there's a lot more nukes in the world now than there were back then. You know, by a lot. And that's with the nuclear drawdowns that have happened in 20 years.
Yeah. And a lot more countries have them.
That's true.
Yeah.
But again, do you kind of see the you know, kind of the similarities between this 1963 that we're seeing in the movie and today, specifically?
Not quite as much, but I think that's a technology issue. The mindsets I can see.
Could we see someone having a doomsday device in today's time?
Oh yeah.
Actually, I honestly believe that Amazon will actually ship you a doomsday device.
Amazon. The doomsday device from Amazon.
It'll be an Amazon Basics.
Oh, you don't even have to be a Plus member? Oh, nice.
Yeah, you can pick it up in one of those stores where you don't even have to have cash on you. You just go and pick it up and they charge you. Yeah, one doomsday device, please. Shut up and take my money.
Yeah. All right.
But what about you, Chris? Do you see some of the ties between now and back then in regards to kind of the scare of annihilation?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, it feels like there's similarities between the two, but I mean, it's not like the same, I guess. Yeah.
All right, so we should talk about one of my all-time favorite comedy scenes, which is the phone call.
Oh, yes.
Oh, God.
I can't believe how much was ad-libbed.
I can. I've seen Peter Sellers at work. I actually saw the outtakes of Lolita, where you just see Peter Sellers just doing different things. And Kubrick is extremely anal when it comes to his shots. You have to do everything as he says, when he says, how he says, no deviations. Only in one instance did he allow basically just carte blanche, and that was with Peter Sellers. And when you see this scene, you can understand exactly why it is that Kubrick gave him this freedom that he never gives anybody else. He has worked with just some of the most, you know, amazing actors of all time, gave him no freedom. He gave carte blanche to Sellers, and then he gave carte blanche to Arlie Emery. Rest in peace. But, yeah, this is, this scene, every time I watch it, I laugh my ass off. And the thing is, we only hear one side of the conversation, and everything that we get is from Sellers for the most part, although we do get some cutaways to Turgidson. And it's all about how, you know, how Muffley is trying to get this point across to his Russian counterpart. And one thing I actually caught only on this time around is this is actually this scene is talking about the Cold War, because if you noticed, the president and the premier are actually competing over who is more sorry.
Well, I'm sorry too. How do you think I feel?
It's like, but I love that aspect that they're that the Russians and the capitalists are constantly competing over everything. There's not one point in the movie where they actually will agree on something. Like the cigar scene. You want some of the finest cigars from Jamaica? No. You know, I don't smoke from...
Oh, many Cubans from the great communist state. And
it's like, I don't smoke from Imperial Stooges. Oh, just the commie Stooges, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, that's the, you know, that's the way that the competition between the two ideologies are. Yet at the same time, they're kind of forced to have to work together in order to keep from destroying the world, right? I mean, if you think I'm wrong, please let me know.
Yeah, it's quiet competition. So, well, it's not as obvious.
Not really.
Yeah, it's one-upsmanship.
Well, I mean, look, when the Russian ambassador comes into the war room, it doesn't take for 5 seconds before Churchison, quote-unquote, finds the camera on the Soviet premier. Now, we don't know for a fact that that camera belongs to the Soviet premier, although we find out later that the Soviet ambassador has a camera in his stopwatch, or his pocket watch. So we do know that he is, in fact, taking cameras. And this is even after it is clear that there's nuclear annihilation. Game's already over, and yet he's still taking pictures. That is what's amazing about this movie, is that it's, even after the game is over, it's still trying to make the point. And then, of course, that brings us to the second best character in this movie, which is, in fact, the title character, Dr. Strangelove. Now, before we talk about Dr. Strangelove, I want to ask you a question. Where was the first place that you saw Dr. Strangelove? When did he show up in the movie?
Almost exactly halfway.
What if I told you that he was there a lot earlier, but you didn't notice?
Well, he's just at the table. I mean, it's possible that he's in shot, but I don't notice him. But
now we should make this clear that Peter Sellers is playing Merkin Muffley, the president.
President and Strangelove.
And he's playing Strangelove, and they're both in this movie. They're both in this particular set, in these scenes. But here's something that was interesting. I didn't realize until I saw for this podcast, but when Turgeson is giving his, you know, when he's being lambasted by the president, you know, he's starting to chew on the, you know, when he's trying to explain how it is that we got to this part where we got to plan R, Strangelove is right behind Turgeson. He's like 4 or 5 seats back, but he's also out of focus. If you're not paying attention, if you don't know who Strangelove looks like, you wouldn't notice at all.
Okay.
But he is at the table. And that little detail, because I was always curious, like, because when he shows up, when we first hear Dr. Strangelove, he just comes out of nowhere, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
And he's almost like a character that was just pulled for the movie just so that we have another character, which also kind of works in its own way if that were the case. But what do you think of Strangelove? What, you know, the way he talks, the way that he, you know, the way he presents himself. What is your initial thoughts about Strangelove?
You know, I know I have it backwards, time stream wise, but after like a minute, I'm like, this is the inspiration for Frankenfurter from Rocky Horror, isn't it?
I would say it would probably be Dr. Scott.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, Dr. Scott. Yeah. Tongue-tied. Brain malfunctioning. I can walk. No.
We'll be getting there.
We'll get to that. Yeah, okay.
But what about you, Chris? What's your initial thoughts on Strangelove?
I like him, and I think he's funny, but the majority of the time, sitting there going, what the fuck is wrong with this guy? And, I mean... Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much...
Well, he's the American expert. He seems to be a very knowledgeable person when it comes to the weapons of war.
Right.
You know, he's obviously a former Nazi, you know, which, if you don't catch it right from the beginning, you definitely find out later.
Yeah.
You know, we get the sense that he was kind of like Wernher von Braun, where, you know, he was captured by the Americans after the war, and forced to work on our side in order to win the Cold War, given clemency as long as he worked for us, right? Or that's kind of the way that they put it. But also, one thing that I find very interesting about it, though, I guess the question that, especially this time around, I find myself really asking a lot. Considering the fact that he only shows up halfway through the film, and for the most part, he pretty much is just an exposition dump. He doesn't really do anything to impact the movie itself, with the exception of perhaps giving us what will happen after the movie's over. Why is the movie titled after him? Why is he the name of the movie?
I sort of have a theory on that, but it doesn't quite work with the narrative.
Well, go ahead and throw it out there. I'm curious.
It feels like this story could be like a story told years after the events of, and it's, well, why are we living underground in this shelter? Well, let me tell you the story of Dr. Strangelove. Because he's the guy that comes up with the idea, everybody underground. Or, not everybody, but the chosen go underground, preserve humanity. And that also explains how I stopped worrying, and I love the bomb. Because I love the bomb so much, because it gave me the opportunity to have a harem. Which is kind of an out there theory when I say it out loud, but at the same time, why would you call this film Dr. Strangelove? He didn't film the bomb. He didn't give the order. He's just talking.
I think I know why, but I'm curious. Okay. Chris, do you have any theories?
I don't have a theory, so yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So here's the question that I found myself asking when it comes to why it was named Dr. Strangelove and then subtitled, or how I stopped worrying and learned to love the bomb. Or learned to stop worrying and love the bomb. When does Dr. Strangelove show up in the story? He shows up after it is revealed that there's a doomsday device, right? That's at the moment that Merkin Muffley calls for Dr. Strangelove to explain how it is that the Russians could have the doomsday device. Now, we know that he is a former Nazi. We know that he is working for the Americans. We know that he knows about these types of weapons, and he does speak with authority when it comes to the validity of a doomsday device, right? Also, the fact is that once the annihilation has begun, the Holocaust has started, and the harem with the approved individuals that are going to be going into the tunnels and the possible breeding of an allowed race were to happen, you get the sense that maybe Strangelove is using this catastrophe to his own nefarious ends, especially considering that we find out that he still has sympathies for the Nazis, you know, especially with his final line in the movie. Also, I find it interesting that that Dr. Strangelove is, if you take the first two letters, is DNS, right? And maybe this is starting to sound a little bit like a certain conspiracy theorist of sorts in all this. But I find that I get the idea that Dr. Strangelove kind of is the embodiment of the destructive nature of war, of arrogant war. That the idea that, you know, the Nazis, that we haven't learned anything from the Nazis, that we're using Nazi philosophy in our war, that the Cold War is basically just World War II part due. You know what I'm saying? And that by creating Doomsday, we are in fact destroying the inferior races. We are setting up master races to go underground and to breed the perfect society, which is everything that the Nazis wanted. And that either Strangelove was working to have that happen, or, you know, was working towards that goal, or was the embodiment of the idea of it. And so that's why I think that it's named Dr. Strangelove, because Strangelove is, in fact, the physical embodiment of the destructive nature of war, of the fallout, so to say, right? And especially with the subtitle, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, it, again, it gives us that sex and violence. Love and bomb is in there, right? So, yeah, that's kind of where I'm coming from in that regard. And that's the best of my ability now. And that might change after a few more revisits. But what do you think? Do you think I got something there?
Maybe, but that's, wow, that's him really manipulating behind the scenes.
Does it seem like he's trying to help stop the Doomsday Device? Do you get this? Because he doesn't actually come out and do anything to help them stop it.
He does flat out dash their hopes and say, no, you can't stop it. That's the point.
And once the president and Turgeson and the military commanders agree to Strangelove's plan about the caves and getting the 2-to-1 of the acceptable women, they have to be of a certain type for breeding purposes.
You know,
that's the moment that he stands up and gives the Hitler salute. Mein Führer, I can walk. His final lines, the final lines in the movie.
Well, yeah, if he can't walk, he can't go down to the shelter.
No, he can. He still has a wheelchair. But again, he's not saying Mr. President. He's saying Mein Führer.
Yeah.
He has basically fulfilled Hitler's desire. And he made the people who defeated Hitler do it.
Yep.
So do you see the connection there?
That might be too deep for Kubrick.
Kubrick is known for going deep.
Yeah.
I mean, hell, we talked about how quote-unquote deep he went in 2001 A Space Odyssey. Yeah. And you could definitely make a case that he's constantly trying to aim for the fences. And I want to say that this is the first time he truly, genuinely went for the fences when it comes to depth. But I also will say that after he did this, he tried way too hard after this movie. And you might even say that he tried way too hard on this movie, but in my opinion, he found that sweet spot in this movie, that perfect middle ground between telling a cohesive story and adding a lot of subtext to it. A lot of just under the surface type of stuff in the movie. And I think that's, you know, he tried after this to constantly finding that level. And for the most part, I don't think he found it. I think that he just tried way too hard and just could never get it again. But I'm pretty sure that there's a Kubrickian somewhere that would love to tell me how awful I am and how wrong I am, and to go line for line over 2001 and Clockwork Orange, which we will eventually get to The Shining, and we will eventually get to Paths of Glory and Lolita, maybe. I don't know. That one's still a little creepy to me. But we'll eventually, I guess we could, if we could do all of Tarantino, we can do all of Kubrick. But,
you know, for a little while, I thought they were also going to go the Fight Club route, and he was just somebody's hallucination. But no, too many people would respond to him. So,
well, that's true.
Yeah.
But should we also bring up the final song in the movie? You know, as the bombs are going off, you know, to me, I think that's. God, we haven't even talked about the bomber. I just realized
negated. We haven't talked about the bomber crew, and okay. We talked about the set for the war room. The bomber set, I think, is more interesting set because they had no military support. They made that whole thing up.
Well,
and
yeah,
it's so real.
Well, that's the thing, though, is that it's over real, especially the amount of knobs and switches. And I know that they had to actually change it again because they have, even if they don't get the military support, they also need to make sure that they're not inadvertently giving away military secrets. So the military still has to look it over, and they told them they had to switch out the displays because it was still too real.
Yeah.
Too much like the real thing. But the thing is that the amounts of switches, the amounts of safeguards, like they have like, what, three different safeguards for the nukes?
Yeah.
Three different toggles. The amount of switches, I think, is the thing that just baffles the hell out of me.
Have you ever been to an air show where you get to walk through, they let you walk through some of the aircraft on the ground?
Not air shows, but I have done like flight simulators, and I have actually gotten to go into a rocket, one of the Mercury or Saturn rockets that's at the Johnson Space Center.
Yeah, well, if you go through an airplane of that era, that's the right number of switches. They're everywhere. It's crazy. You just look at it and go, damn, how did... With all these switches, where did they find room for a cabinet to put all these plans and their...
Well, why do you think they had to have three people in the cockpit?
Well, I know you need pirate co-pilot.
You also have to have comms.
Navigator and bombardier. So.
Well, the bombardier isn't in the cockpit, though. The bombardier isn't with the payload.
Yeah, but they're all... In this set, they're all kind of just... They're not that far from each other. If it wasn't for the fact the aircraft was so loud, they could probably just talk, but soundproofing is not important on a bomber. So,
also, I find it very interesting that the pilot, Major Kong, like as soon as he gets the code that we're going to war with Russia, he switches out his helmet with a cowboy hat.
Yeah.
Like right at that particular point. And I'll just say right now, the one thing you really, 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 really want when it comes to a nuclear war is a cowboy in the cockpit.
Hey, that's America.
Well, I mean, look at what he does, though. I mean, you got to give it to Kong. He knows how to fly. I mean, hell, he was able to get that bomber under radar. Yeah. And that's a huge plane. I don't have to tell you just how scary it is to be in a big-ass plane like that, flying at under 500 feet, especially over rocky terrain, even if it is green screen.
Yeah.
Oh, come on. It was so blatantly green screen.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's by our standards, pretty bad green screen, but at the same time, it's not bad for the air.
It was intentional.
It was
intentional. They didn't have the budget for that. They weren't going to be spending that much money on a satire like this. And understand, they had big-ass actors in this movie. You know, and if I'm not correct, I think about 55-60% of the budget went to Peter Sellers' salary.
Well, originally Sellers was going to be King Kong.
Yeah.
But between...
And then he had an accident and had to step down.
And then they got the genius of...
Slim Pickens
in, who just showed up basically in his regular clothing, and they looked at him and went, "You're already in costume. Amazing."
No, you're already in character.
Yeah.
He wasn't in a flight suit.
No, that was the only thing he was missing, was the flight jacket. Like, oh, okay. You're perfect. Go.
But I will say, okay, so the stuff that's in the cockpit, for the most part, is not the most interesting. Basically, they're kind of a placeholder just to let us know what the ticking time bomb is. No pun intended. Because the closer that they get, and we get the sense that this is the crew that's going to launch the bomb. If any of them are going to do it, it's going to be this crew, right? And I also find it very interesting that while we... are hoping that this bomb doesn't go off, we also really like this crew that we also kind of hope that they succeed.
Yeah.
So the movie is playing with our emotions, because if we didn't know that this bomb would, start the doomsday device, we'd want them to drop their payload, right? In an average war movie, we'd be hoping for their success, right?
Oh, yeah.
So the movie is kind of, and it gets back to my third favorite moment in the movie, which is when Turgidson explains to the president how these bombers are so good, and just as he realizes that, yeah, they will actually drop those bombs, and that realization on his face.
It's like he's cheering for his favorite team to win, and then remembers that all of his money is on the other team. It's exactly the look on his face. It's like, yeah, my boys are gonna... Crap.
No, it's not. It's just the way that he kind of... As soon as he says, you goddamn right they will... He puts his fingers to his mouth, like, oh my, that's not good. But again, I love that. When we see them flying that low, especially they are the man on the mission, right? They are moving forward. That we actually like these guys. Or as much as we can, considering that we really don't get to know them much more than that they're flying a mission. In a way, they're the most, the most military movie-like. I mean, this is, if we were just watching this group, if we didn't go back to Washington or to Burleson, if we just stayed with this group, we would want them to launch these nukes. We would want to see them succeed because... they've got a job to do, and we understand the stakes. We understand why they should succeed, right?
Yeah.
Right.
But at the same time, though, Kubrick is playing that along with the knowledge that we do know. We know what's going to happen if they get these bombs off. And so he's daring us to root for them. He's almost wanting us to root for them just so that he can... have the last laugh, so he could feel like he's pulling the rug out from underneath you, just a little bit. And so when they, and at the same time, especially like on this time around when I was watching it, I realized at all these places that they could have stopped the mission, right? Oh, their communications got hit. They're running out of gas. They should just ditch the plane and... we see that they have the survival kit so that they would, in fact, be able to manage themselves. The 100 in gold, 100 in rubles, the makeshift Russian library or Russian dictionary and Holy Bible.
Made me laugh because just how ridiculous that Bible looked. But
The part that made me laugh was the 3 prophylactics, nylons, and... When to that, I was like, what are you expecting these guys to be doing in Russia?
I actually get what the nylons and the lipsticks for. It's trade items.
Yeah, it is trade items. It's but again, trade, the thing is...
So is the gum, actually. Well, half of that kit is actually just to trade the people. Now, if this were in Vietnam, I'd say the prophylactic's purpose is actually you put it on the gun so it doesn't get wet when you walk through a river. But they didn't have that trick until in Vietnam, so yeah. Okay, maybe they are planning a good time in Vegas.
But here's the interesting thing about it, though. If you look at everything besides the pistol, it's all focused around either the mouth or the penis.
Well, it's edibles that's focused around the mouth, mostly, except for the lipstick. The pantyhose are not around the penis. They're around the leg. But
again, the whole thing is that you could use that as a means of attracting sex. Or you could put it on yourself as a disguise.
As a strainer in an emergency.
I mean, there's other things you could use nylons for. But I'm just saying, though, that especially considering that this, in the order of things, comes after prophylactics. So you're not exactly thinking about strainer at that point. But at the same time, though, I am wondering if maybe that there shouldn't be, like, some sort of YouTube channel that's taking all these items and seeing what they could actually, in fact, do with that.
That would be a weird... this probably is a video somewhere. It's YouTube. There it is.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. But most of the items and in that kit are... I'd say they're practical and usable, except for that mini phrasebook and Bible. There's no way. How can you read that?
Well, with glasses.
Oh.
Magnifying glass.
Or maybe if you put the nylons on, it'll help you read. I don't know.
I don't know.
All right. But again, I mean, the thing is, though, is that with the exception of that, we know that they could survive the plane crashing. They don't have to do the mission.
Right.
Yet they're so bound and determined that even when they can't reach their targets, they're going to find a new target.
Yeah.
Like, they don't have to.
Which actually throws off the plan. Oh, yeah, you guys could stop one bomber. Just throw everything to this place or this place because it's the primary and secondary targets. They're not going to hit anybody else. And they go just someplace else.
And just so, just to throw a little bit of logic in all this, I'm pretty sure that the Russians would have had their airplanes up looking for it and then just tailing the plane.
Yeah.
But, again, that's throwing a little logic here. This is not a movie about logic. This is a movie about satire. But, look, I know that we're running a little late on this, so we'll go ahead and we'll tie this up. But is there anything specific that you wanted to bring up about the movie?
I had somebody online tell me I had a harsh comment when I made the comment about this movie. Doctor Strangelove, or what the Fallout series stole from Stanley Kubrick to make it to a video game series. So,
well,
a lot
technically
of this
speaking, Fallout would have happened after, Doctor Strangelove.
Yeah, well, some of the setup for it is like, in that timeline of that video game series is, oh, here's a company that built these huge underground shelters, which sounds exactly like the end scenes, and they do experiments.
So are they going to run weird experiments in these caves? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, they could. Hey, it's the military doing whatever they feel like. So,
no, this is Strangelove doing whatever he feels like.
Yeah, that too, yeah. Vault-Tec is Strangelove. You heard it here. And actually, in one of the... I mean, you get the impression that the Cuban... Russian ambassador, he may be just told, if we hurry up and build these shelters, why don't you just not even go home? Just stay with us. In one of the original games, one of the characters is descended from a Russian ambassador who happened to be in the shelters. Like, how'd that happen? There's all sorts of little things that's like, this movie clearly inspired a lot of stuff later. So,
no, I will say another line that I thought was really hilarious. Was when Turgeson is curious about Strangelove's name, and the guy says, "Well, he changed it. What used to be Merk von Diebleble,
which is,
and that's basically Strangelove in German."
Yeah.
Yes, it was. Again, it's these little things, and it's one of those movies you have to watch like 3 or 4 times to really catch everything that is being thrown at you. There's stuff you're going to catch the first time around, but a lot of these are little details that are kind of stuck in the background, or, kind of a glance that's given at a certain time, or a cutaway shot that occurs between characters. That's the beautiful thing about what this movie does, in my opinion. But what about you, Chris? Is there anything else you want to bring up about the movie?
I don't think so.
Now, it should be said that this movie did... When this movie was being made, another movie was being made called Failsafe, which was literally the exact same idea, but done seriously. It starred Henry Fonda as the president after an American bomber accidentally lets loose a bomb on a Russian target. The American president has to, in order to keep a nuclear war from happening, allow Russia to bomb one of America's cities. And it's a pretty tense movie. Have y'all seen Failsafe by any chance?
No.
Nope.
In fact, they did a live version of it on CBS, I want to say about 15 years ago, with Richard Dreyfuss and George Clooney and Don Cheadle. I think you can find it on YouTube. But they did it kind of live like they do on NBC with their musicals.
Okay.
So, give you a chance to say to see something interesting that's kind of in the same lab. But the thing was is that Doctor Strange was intended to come out before Failsafe, but because of the whole, you know, Dallas thing, Failsafe came out first, and then Doctor Strangelove, which of course had people wondering, you know, oh, did you take from Failsafe? And they both were going up for Oscars, and Doctor Strangelove lost in every category that it was nominated, which
sucks.
I guess I'm...
Sucks. It should have won something. So...
Well, okay, so it was nominated for Best Picture. It was nominated for Best Actor for Peter Sellers. It was nominated for Best Director and Best Screenwriting, Best Screenplay. Honestly, if George C. Scott would have gotten nominated for Best Supporting Actor, that would have been the one that I would have said had to have won. George C. Scott just killed that role. And like I said, I still say... that performance is one of the 10 best. And that's even better than Sellers, which is a pretty tall order because he killed in all three of his roles. But what about you, Chris? Do you think that that this should have won that year?
I don't know what it was up against at the time.
Well, the winner for Best Picture for that year was... I believe My Fair Lady.
Mm.
Or no, Around the World in 80 Days. This was the year that Around the World in 80 Days won Best Picture.
And, no, yeah, Rex Harrison won Best Male Lead for My Fair Lady.
No, so. And I'm sorry, it was in fact My Fair Lady that won Best Picture, not Around the World. It was also going up against Mary Poppins, Beckett, and Zorba the Greek.
Hmm.
Oddly, it didn't even get nominated for Best Black and White Cinematography.
Well, I wouldn't have given it that. Of all the movies, this is not one of the best photographed. In fact, if you notice, most of the things that are happening are out of focus, which I think was intended by Kubrick, but I still don't think that it works. But then again, I'm one of those that's not a, a Kubrickian, so... You know, I can be honest. But, alright, so anything else?
Probably think of something genius to say right after we're done recording.
Well, that's what Twitter's for.
Yeah.
Which, of course...
Dub it in later.
Oh, we'll get into that.
Yeah. If only all they right, had so Twitter on the bomber. Going to New Kosher, right, I can't believe it.
Let's do Geek Sheet right quick.
Okay, for... Quick geek sheet. I know we're missing some, probably some things major, but you know, this is what I'm pulling down. Peter Sellers, mostly known for Pink Panther, which I did check. You're right, Pink Panther came out the year before this. So I don't know if it was being, if they were filmed or if it came out before they started filming, but yeah. So George C. Scott, who we've previously seen in Patton, also known for The Hustler and, you know, just being George C. Scott. Sterling Hayden was in The Godfather. Come on.
Yes, yeah. He was the captain.
Yeah,
he was the,
he's the captain. Yeah, the only... next up, Keenan Wynn. I just have to say, he's in the classic bad Laser Blast. That's, you know, an MST3K.
But he was also in Nashville.
Yeah. Slim Pickens is just a cowboy legend. Slim Pickens.
Words.
Blazing Saddles.
Blazing Saddles.
Yep.
And if you thought he was funny in this movie, watch Blazing Saddles and you'll realize just how good he is at comedy.
Yep. We've kind of touched on James Earl Jones for, you know, we just did him in Conan a couple weeks ago. So just go back a couple episodes, watch Conan, listen to our podcast, and know the power of this 40-owned and operational podcast, since he's also Vader and, you know, the Lion in Lion King. I had this as a last-minute addition. Jack Creeley was Oblivion in Videodrome, the one President's aide, So the guy, one of the few guys in this movie who does not have a really bizarre name in this movie, goes on to have a bizarre name in another movie.
Well, he is going to be in Videodrome. Bizarre in that movie.
Yeah.
All right, I do want to bring up one quick thing, right quick. I have one extra thing I want to add, which is Pablo Ferro. Now, Pablo Ferro is pretty much only known for title cards in movies.
Yeah.
You know, the fonts of the titles that you see in the beginning of movies. Now, there's two in specific that I will bring up for Pablo Ferro, both of which are Barry Sonnenfeld-directed films, namely The Addams Family and Men in Black. And if you'll notice, both of those fonts are pretty close to the fonts for Doctor Strangelove. And I want to say that Barry Sonnenfeld wanted those fonts to look exactly like the ones for Doctor Strangelove. So that might not be an accident.
You know, when I first saw Men in Black, I thought it was going for a comic book effect. But now that you mention it, when compared to this, it is kind of the same thing.
Yeah. And if you really want to see just how much this guy is influencing on title cards, just go to his IMDb page.
Yeah.
It's insane. just saying.
And he made a mistake during the title cards of this.
What's that?
When it goes to based on the novel, he left out the D in based. It just says base on the novel.
Nobody's perfect.
Yeah.
Or also say Popeye's nerfect.
Yeah. It's like, dang it! I was looking for
it. No movies without sin. That's why we're here.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, so let's go ahead and let's call a gentleman. Kent, Chris, do you give it... I'm sorry. Kent, Chris, do you agree with the critics on Doctor Strangelove or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb? Do you give it a pass? Do you give it a fail? Or do you give it a maybe? Kent.
You know, I've watched this film 3 times since Saturday. Almost every 2 days in the last week I've watched this. And I almost could go for a fourth time. And you know how rare that is for me to do that. This could end up being one of my top 5 of all time movies. I mean, it's near perfection here. And so I'm definitely giving it a pass. I may be saying the critics haven't hailed it enough. So,
well, I don't know. That's a tall order when it comes to Kubrick.
Yeah. And definitely better pace than, you know, that other Kubrick film I liked, you know, that involved flying and aliens. So, yeah, definitely a clear pass for me, and I'm going to guess a clear pass for everybody else, because that is what we want. Yes?
Well, okay. Let's find out.
Yes.
Chris?
Yeah, it's a pass for me, but I guess I just, I don't know, I don't think I was in the mood to watch it, because I'm like, if you're really tired and you're trying to watch this, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I still enjoy it. I liked it a lot more the first time I watched it. It was just, I don't know, something was missing this time when I watched it. I'm still giving it a pass. It's still a great movie. I think it's probably one of Kubrick's, I don't want to say best, but I do kind of feel like it is. I guess it's easier accessible than something like 2001. So, anyway, yeah, I already said pass like 4 times, but pass, pass, yeah. Pass.
Yeah.
I would bore everyone by giving a pass like 15 or 16 or 20 times because, again, I love this movie. I will easily say that this is the best Kubrick film. Although, that said, I do actually enjoy a couple of other Kubrick films, just not the ones that the Kubrickians kind of fawn over. In fact, I will say that those movies are pretty bad. But, you know, Dr. Strangelove is the perfect culmination of the obsession that Kubrick is known for with the meticulousness of his screenwriting and just the brilliant way that he was able to get the performances that he did from his actors, specifically George C. Scott. Now, one thing we didn't bring up when it comes to George C. Scott was Scott really wanted to play it straight. He was adamant about playing Turgeson as a straight character, a straight-edge character, and Kubrick kind of tricked him into giving this performance by saying, okay, well, first, do it this crazy way on the first take, and then for the rest of the takes, do it straight-laced. And he took the first shot every single time with Scott. And again, I have never seen Scott like this before or since. And it's brilliant. I wish, you know, I think Scott is kind of, before he died, I think he did soften up on this. I know that he was really pissed off at Kubrick for a long time over what he did. But I only wish that he could understand just how amazing this performance is and how brilliant he was capable. And I think a part of it was the fact that he hesitated, that he didn't want to do it, that he just went for broke. Because you look at this performance, and I don't know about you, but I could see the makings of Michael Keaton. You know, you can look at this, and in a way you could see Michael Keaton doing his Batman or his Beetlejuice and see a lot of that stemming from this performance, that combination of deadpan and wild crazy. And then you have Peter Sellers, who's doing three completely different characters. All of them are vital pieces to the puzzle, and yet he is just giving his all to all three of these characters. And then, of course, all the other performers that it would just take me forever to go through all of them. And it just, it's fun, it's brilliant, it's a movie that I can't wait to watch again. This is a movie that, and I mentioned, I have bought this movie 4 or 5 times because I always want the extra features. I want to know everything about this movie that I can, and I relish in every interview that I can get my hands on in regards to this movie, because I still can't believe that this movie was ever made. The writing is so damn strong. The comedy is so damn strong. The seriousness, the tension is there. And I get caught up every single time I've seen this movie. And I've seen this movie more than I've seen other movies. And I get caught up in the finale. And I feel like I'm constantly being suckered by Kubrick. And again, considering how I feel about Kubrick and the fact that I think that he's overrated, you know, when it comes to a lot of his films. But I can't say that about this movie. It's just too damn perfect in that sense. Not perfect all over the place, because, you know, there's lots of problems. But I love this movie. And in fact, I might just have to see it after we're done with this podcast, because now I'm just all excited. But gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me for this episode. Kent, what do we have coming up?
Next up is Sicario.
Well, so if you have anything you'd like to say about any of the episodes that we have, including this one, and how awful a human being I am for not loving all of Kubrick's movies, you can certainly do so on the Facebook page as well as on Twitter at Arthouse Legends, or you can definitely send us an email at arthouselegends@gmail.com, and I will get back to you as soon as possible. If you want to show some support to the show, you can certainly do so by going onto the iTunes page for Art House Legends and giving us a 5-star review. That will definitely help us get the word out on this movie or on this show. Also, just to let you know, if you have Spotify, we are now on Spotify. If you'd like to check out any of our prior shows or keep up with our new shows there as well, we would love for you to join us on there. Gentlemen, thank you so much for coming on to this podcast. This is the Movie Dude, Eric.
This is Kent.
And this is Chris.
And